or evening special. Standard practice in post-tender reports was to interview only the team leader and the divisional head, but Bryant had been crowing about Chris's performance from the moment they cut him out of the wreckage of his BMW. Makin had gone conspicuously unmentioned.
That? Bryant gave him a wry grin. Well, let's just say I'm not flavour of the month with Miss Linshaw at the moment.
Chris frowned. His nerves were still a little shot from the duel, and he found his mind tended to skitter when he tried to concentrate. At the same time, as if compensating for its poor performance in other areas, it spat chunks of memory at him with near total recall. Now, as if listening to it on tape, he heard the words Liz Linshaw had used over the radio that first morning as he drove into the new job at Shawn. Still nothing on the no-name orbital call-out for Mike Bryant at Shawn Associates. Don't know where you've got to, Mike, but if you can hear me, we're anxious to hear from you. He strained to remember Bryant and Linshaw's body language the evening of the quarterly review party, but his recall was too alcohol-damaged to trust.
Were you two,
Bryant grinned and sank half his whiskey.
If by that delicate "ah" you mean fucking, then yes, yes, we were fucking.
Chris sat still, remembering Suki. As if reading his mind, Bryant said,
"It was no big deal, scratching an itch, you know. She gets off on drivers the way some guys do on Italian holoporn. It was back when Suki was, you know, off sex, just after Ariana was born."
He shrugged.
"Like I said, no big deal."
Chris tried to think of an appropriate question to fill the space. In the background, something insipid lilted from the bar's sound system.
"So how long did it last?"
"Well," Bryant turned to face him, getting comfortable, "in the initial stages, about 8 months. I'm telling you, Chris, she was hot.
We both were.
She was doing this in-depth study of conflict investment for a series, and then, you know, that book, The New Asphalt Warriors, so we saw a lot of each other without anyone wondering. She used to do these interviews, and then we'd get off camera and fuck like rabbits wherever there was a lockable door. I used to get hard-ons just talking to her on camera. Even after the series was wrapped, we were fucking 2 or 3 times a week in hotels around the city, or the car. She really liked that, the car. Then it sort of cooled off. Once a week, sometimes not even that. And Suki came back online, so there was that as competition. I'd missed Suki, you know. And that whole pin-up buzz thing was fading anyway. There were about 6 months when Liz and I didn't see each other at all."
Another grin.
"Then she made, like, this amazing comeback. She asked me out to the studio one night after everyone had gone home. I wasn't going to go at first, but I was curious, you know. Man, I'm glad I went."
Bryant leaned closer, still grinning.
"We fucked on the interview set, and she filmed the whole thing with one of those big studio cameras. Then she mailed me the fucking disc at work. You believe that? I mean, I didn't know at the time she was doing it, otherwise I'd never have agreed. Then suddenly there's this Studio 10 disc on my desk with Souvenir written on it."
"Jesus."
Bryant nodded.
"I thought at first she was going to send it to Suki. Fact, I thought she already had when I got my copy. But when I called her, she just asked how I liked it, and if I wanted a repeat performance. So the last 6 months we've been repeat performing a couple of times a month, and it's still as hot as ever."
"And Suki?"
"She doesn't know. You know, the weird thing is, you'd think I'd go back to Suki too tired to perform, but it's not like that. I'm more buzzed when I get home from a session with Liz than I would be if I hadn't had sex all week. It's that fucking disc, man. It makes you feel like a fucking porn star."
"So what's the problem now?"
"Ah, nothing really. We had this big fight the last time we met up to fuck."
Bryant's gaze floated off into the corners of the bar. The carnal shine faded from his face. He seemed disinclined to go on.
"What about?"
Bryant sighed.
"Ah, shit. Chris, do you think I was right to shoot those gangwit motherfuckers that night at the Falkland?"
"Yeah, sure."
Chris heard himself and stopped.
"I mean..."
"See, that's what I think.
They were..."
"Fucking go to trash us, right?"
Chris gestured.
Yeah.
"Right, that's what I said. It's what Suki says. It's what the fucking corporate police inquiry says. So what's the big deal?"
"She doesn't buy it?"
Bryant glanced at him.
"What's to buy? I told her the truth."
"What about the machetes?" Machetes? Wrecking bars? What's the fucking difference? I don't even remember which thing I told her.
Bryant swallowed more whiskey and waved his glass laterally.
Didn't matter. She said I was a fucking animal. Get that? I was an animal. Never mind the fuckers with the crowbars. I was a fucking animal. You understand that?
Chris crowded Carla's voice out of his head with a pull at his own drink. She wasn't there, man.
That's right. She wasn't.
Bryant stared broodingly at the bottles behind the bar.
Fucking reporters.
Chris snapped his fingers and the liveried barman arrived as if on rails. Bryant didn't look at him. Chris indicated their glasses.
Fill us up.
The liquor drizzled down, catching the light.
Got work to do tomorrow, Bryant said gloomily. Makin's right, you'll see. They'll want 25 fucking drafts of that contract before it's put to bed. Bentick, from the DTC, I know that motherfucker, and he wants every I double-dotted just in case his precious minister runs into embarrassing questions on civilian casualties or some such shit.
Worry about it tomorrow, Chris raised his glass. Here, small wars.
Yeah, small wars.
Crystal chimed between them. Bryant knocked back the whiskey in one and signalled the barman again. He watched the glass fill up.
I'm an animal, he muttered with bitter disbelief. I'm a fucking animal.
They kicked it in the head about an hour later, when it became clear that no amount of drinking was going to extract Bryant from his sudden puddle of gloom. Chris half carried his friend to the elevator and along the corridor to his room, where he propped him against the wall while he fumbled with keys. Once inside the room, he hauled Mike most of the way onto the pristine expanse of king-size bed and set about unlacing his shoes. Bryant began to snore. Chris took off the shoes and shoveled Mike's unshod feet up onto the bed with the rest of him. As Chris bent over him to remove his tie, the other man stirred.
Liz?
He queried blearily.
Not a chance,
said Chris, loosening the knot on his tie.
Oh.
Bryant heaved up his head and made an attempt to focus.
Chris, don't even think about it, man. Don't even think about it.
I won't. Chris finished unknotting the tie and stripped it from around Bryant's neck with a single, hard tug.
That's right.
Bryant's head fell back on the bed again, and his eyes rolled sluggishly closed.
You're a good guy, Chris. That's you. You're a fucking good guy.
He drifted off to sleep. Chris left him there snoring and let himself quietly out of the room. He slipped into his own room like a thief and went to his hotel bed, where he lay awake a while, masturbating to the thought of Liz Linshaw's tanned thighs and cleavage. It was very quiet inside the limo now. The torrential rain of the storm had died back to a persistent drizzle that smeared the windows but no longer drummed on the roof. The limo's Rolls-Royce engine made slightly less noise than the rush of its tires on the wet asphalt outside. The loudest sound in the rear cabin was the chirrup of Louise Hewitt's laptop as it processed data. Maps and graphs came and went, summoned and dismissed by the deft ripple of Hewitt's hands across the deck. Projections for the Cambodian conflict altered minutely as new potential elements were factored in. Crop failures, what if? Typhoon impact, what if? Hong Kong Federation cuts diplomatic ties, what if? Bryant's preliminary work was an inspired piece of modelling, but Hewitt believed in tracking her subordinates and pushing for potential weaknesses until they emerged. It was an exercise in basic security. As with any alloy, you didn't know the material well until you knew what would break it. The car phone purred up at her from where it was curled on the seat like a red-eyed cat. She killed the phone's video option and picked up the handset, eyes still fixed on the Hong Kong Federation variant.
Yes?
A familiar voice crackled in her ear. She smiled.
On my way to Edinburgh, why?
Crackle, crackle.
No, I didn't think there was any point. I've got breakfast with a client in the Howard at 8 and contracts to go over before that.
Crackle, crackle, snap. Hewitt's smile broadened.
Oh, is that what you thought? Well, sorry to disappoint you, but I wouldn't have come all the way up here just for that. Good enough to eat, though you looked.
The phone crackled some more. Hewitt sighed and hoisted her gaze to the roof. Her voice became soothing.
"Yes, media exposure's a powerful thing. But I was sitting there, remember? I really wouldn't worry about it if I were you."
The voice in her ear grew agitated, and Hewitt's good-natured exasperation hardened. She sat forward.
"All right, listen. You just let me worry about Faulkner. You leave him alone."
The crackling stopped on a sharp question mark.
"Yes, I know. I was there, remember. It's no big surprise, to be honest. Look, it's just an angle."
Snap, crackle, incredulous.
"Yes, I do."
Snap, question.
"Because that's what they pay me for. I don't have the details worked out yet, but it shouldn't take much leverage."
Crackle, crackle, crackle.
"Mike Bryant will do as he's told. That's the difference between them, and you need to remember that. Now, we've talked about this enough. I'll be back in London day after tomorrow. We can meet and discuss it then."
Sullen crackle. Silence. Hewitt cradled the phone and grinned to herself in the quiet gloom. Chapter 14.
"Seen enough?"
Eric Nyquist got up and held the cracked remote closer to the screen. The red active light winked feebly a couple of times, and the program credits continued to scroll down, superimposed over an aerial view of Nakamura wreckage. Finally, Eric gave up on the failing remote and snapped on the blue standby screen manually. In the glow it cast, he turned back to face his daughter. Carla sat, glass in hand, and stared at the place the images had been.
"The hero of the hour," Eric grunted. "Jesus, the irony of that. Butcher a couple of fellow human beings to maximize neo-colonial profiteering half the globe away, and you're a goddamn hero."
"Dad," Carla said tiredly.
"You heard her. This is a great moment for you, Chris, and your beloved husband sitting there, grinning like a Mormon. I wouldn't be in this line of work if I didn't like it, Liz. Christ."
"He had no choice. The woman on the left was his boss, and from what I hear, she already doesn't like him. What was he supposed to do? If he stepped out of line the way you want, he'd probably lose his job."
"I know that."
Eric went to the table that served him as an open-plan drinks cabinet and began to mix himself another vodka and orange.
"Been there, bought the T-shirt. But sometimes you have to stand by the odd principle, you know."
"Yes, I know,"
Carla snapped, surprising herself.
"And where did that get you in the end, standing by your much-vaunted principles?"
"Well, let's see."
Eric grinned down into the glass he was pouring. Having provoked her, he was now backing cheerfully down again. It was one of his favorite drinking games.
"I was arrested, held without trial under the Corporate Communications Act, shunned by my so-called friends and colleagues, blacklisted by every news editor in the country, and refused a credit rating. I lost my job, my home, and any hopes for the future. Nothing that a young man of Chris's caliber couldn't take in his stride. The trouble is, he just lacks the vision to make it happen."
Carla smiled, despite herself.
"Liked that one, did you?"
Eric lifted his glass in her direction.
"For once, it's something I just made up. Cheers."
"Cheers."
She barely sipped at her own neat vodka. It had taken her the whole news report to get three fingers down the drink, and now it was warm.
"Dad, why do you stay here? Why don't you go back to Tromsø?"
"And meet your mother in the high street every day? No thanks. I'm living with enough guilt as it is."
"She isn't there most of the time, and you know it."
"Okay. I just see her every time she comes back from some particularly successful book launch or lecture tour."
Eric shook his head.
"I don't think my ego's up to that. Besides, after all these years, who would I know?"
"All right. You could move to Oslo. Write a column back there."
"Carla, I already do."
Eric gestured at the battered computer in the corner.
"See that? It's got a wire in the back that goes all the way to Norway. Marvelous what they can do with technology these days."
"Oh, shut up."
"Carla."
The mockery drained from his tone.
"What am I going to change moving back there now?
It isn't as if the costs are prohibitive here. Even with the zone tax on top, email is so cheap you can't realistically cost it on the number of articles I mail out in a month. And even if you could, even if I was walking my work to the editors in Oslo to save money, I'd spend what I saved on winter socks.
Don't exaggerate, it's not that cold.
I think you're forgetting.
Dad, her voice grew very gentle. We were there in January.
Oh, she heard, in that single gruff syllable, how much it hurt him. He made a point of looking her in the face.
Visiting your mother?
She shook her head.
There wasn't time, and anyway, I think she was in New Zealand. Chris took me to the Winter Wheels show in Stockholm, and we went across to see Sonjafjord on the way back. He'd never been there.
And it wasn't cold? Come on, Carla. I may not be able to afford flights on a whim, but it hasn't been so long.
All right, it was cold. Yes, it was cold. But, Dad, it was so...
She gave up and gestured around her.
Dad, look at this place.
Yeah, I know. I haven't tidied it up for a while, but...
You know what I mean?
Eric looked at her in silence. Then he went to the window and tugged back one of the ragged curtains. Outside, something had been set on fire, and it painted leaping shadows on the ceiling above where he stood. Shouts came through the thin glass pane.
Yes, he said softly. I know what you mean. You mean this. Urban decay as only the British know how to do it. And here I am, 57 years old, and stuck in the middle of it.
She avoided his eyes.
It's just so civilized back there, Dad. There's nobody sleeping on the streets.
Just as well. They'd freeze to death.
She ignored him.
Nobody dying because they can't afford medical attention. No old people too poor to afford heating and too scared to go out after dark. Dad, there are no gang zones, no armored police trucks. There's no exclusion like there is here.
It sounds as if you should be talking to Chris, not me.
Eric knocked back a large portion of his drink in one gulp. It was an angry gesture, and his voice carried the ragged echo of the emotion.
Maybe you can persuade him to move up there if you like it so much. Though it's hard to see what you'd both do for a living without anybody to kill on the roads.
She flinched. He saw it, and reined himself in.
Carla.
She looked at her lap, said nothing. He sighed.
Carla, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that.
Yes, you did.
No.
He set down his drink and came to crouch in front of her.
No, I didn't, Carla. I know you're just doing what you have to get by. We all are. Even Chris, I know that. But can't you see? An argument for me going back to Norway is an equally valid argument for you. How do you think I feel, looking at you stuck in the middle of this?
The thought stopped her like a slap. Her hands tightened on his.
Dad!
She swallowed and started again.
Dad, that's not it, is it? You're not staying because of me.
He chuckled and lifted her chin with one hand.
Staying because of you? Staying to protect you with all the money and influence I've amassed? Yeah, that's right.
Then tell me why.
Why?
He stood up, and for a moment she thought she was in for another lecture. Instead he went to stand at the window again, staring out. The flames were stronger now, and they stained his face with orange.
Do you remember Monica Hansen?
Your photographer?
Eric smiled.
I'm not sure she'd like the possessive pronoun, but yes, Monica the photographer. She's back in Oslo now, taking photos of furniture for some catalogue. She's bored, Carla. The money's okay, but she's bored to screaming.
Better bored than sleeping in the streets.
Don't exaggerate, Carla. I'm not sleeping in the streets. And no, listen to me a moment. Think about it. You said yourself there's no exclusion there like there is here. So what would I write about? Back in the comfort and safety of my own Scandinavian social system. No, Carla. This is the front line. This is where I can make a difference.
No one wants you to make a difference, Dad.
She got up from the chair, suddenly angry again, and faced him. She jerked back the other curtain and glared angrily down at the fire below.
"Look at that!"
The source of the flames, she saw as she gestured, was an overturned armchair. Other items lay scattered around, unrecognizable in the darkness and as yet untorched. A shattered window directly above suggested an origin. Someone had been in one of the first-floor apartments, throwing down what it contained. Now figures in baggy, hooded sportswear stood gathered around the fire, making Carla think of menacing, negative-image Disney dwarfs out of some nightmare where it all definitely did not end happily ever after.
"Look at it," she hissed again. "You think those people care what you write? You think most of them can even read? You think people like that care about you making a difference?"
"Don't be so quick to judge, Carla. Like Benito says, don't make 3D judgments of what you can only see on your TV screen."
"Oh, for—"
Her expletives evaporated in an exasperation too old and deep for words. She rapped hard on the glass.
"This isn't a TV, Dad. It's a fucking window, and you live here. You tell me what we're looking at. Community night barbecue, maybe?"
Eric sighed. "No.
It's probably gang retribution for something. Someone they thought informed on them, someone who spoke out of turn. They did the same thing to Mrs. McKenney last summer because she wouldn't let her son run balloons for them. Of course, then he had to, just to buy some new furniture. You can't fault the gangwits on psychology."
He turned away from the window, and suddenly, in the motion, she saw how tired he had become. The vision only fanned the flames of her anger again. Up from the pit of her stomach, a licking, gusting sickness. Eric appeared not to sense it coming. He was freshening his drink again, working on an ironic grin to match it.
"Of course, it could just be kids having fun. Random stuff. A lot of those first-floor apartments have been empty for longer than I've been here. They just break in and—"
He shrugged and drank.
"And throw the stuff out the window?"
Suddenly she was yelling at him, really yelling.
"And set fire to it? For fun? Jesus fucking Christ, Dad, will you listen to yourself? You think this is normal? Are you fucked in the head?"
The flashback caught like magnesium ribbon behind her eyes. 11 years old again, and screaming at her father as he tried to explain what he had done and why she had to choose. It burned out as fast, afterimage inked onto her retina and the returning dimness of the room. She looked up quickly, caught the expression on Eric's face, and knew he was remembering too.
"Dad, I'm sorry," she whispered.
Too late. He didn't say it, but he didn't need to. Silence was settling around them in little black shreds, like scorched down from a pillow shot through at close range.
"Dad."
She had thought for a moment he might yell back, but he didn't. He only moved slightly, the way she sometimes saw Chris move when some piece of driving-induced injury caught him awkwardly. He moved and nodded to himself as if her scream had been a swallow of rough but interesting whiskey. She saw the way he was composing himself and knew what was coming.
"Normal?"
He said the word with careful pedantry that almost hid the returning gruffness in his voice.
"Well, I think, in the context of the slaughter we've just seen committed by the man you share your bed with—"
"Dad, please."
His voice trampled hers down.
"I'd call it normal, yes. In fact, I'd call it comparatively healthy. Burned furniture you can always replace. Burned flesh is a little harder."
She breathed deliberately, loosening the tightness in her chest.
"Listen, Dad, I'm not going to—"
"Of course, there is always the double standard to consider. As Mazo would have put it, crime is a matter of degrees, and the degree that really matters in society's eyes is the extent to which the criminal has asserted himself beyond his designated social class and status."
"Oh, bullshit, Dad!"
But the anger had deserted her, and all she could feel now was the edge of tears. She held on to her drink with clumsy 11-year-old hands and watched as her father retreated, swathing himself in the gauze bandage of political rhetoric to hide the hurt. "The sons and daughters of the powerful buy and sell drugs among themselves with impunity because all they have done is overstep slightly the license their class entitles them to, misunderstood the lip service to legality that must be paid if the common herd are to continue grazing quietly. But let one child from the Bruntland enter their fairy kingdom and do the same, and watch the full bloody weight of the law fall on him, because he has presumed to behave as he is not entitled, presumed to not know his place. And that we cannot allow." "Dad," she tried once more, voice pitched low and urgent, "please, Dad, look down there again. Never mind whose fault it is. Never mind the politics of it. Do you think anyone down there gives a flying fuck what you write? Do you think they give a fuck about anything any more?"
"And my son-in-law does?"
He did not turn to the window, but his eyes were bright with a reflected fire-glow.
"Chris gives a flying fuck for the bodies he left on the motorway today, or the bodies that they'll be stacking in the streets of Phnom Penh a year from now? You know what I wish, Carla? I wish you'd married one of those edge dealers down there, instead of that suited piece of shit you sleep with. The dealer, at least, I could make excuses for."
"That's great, Dad."
Finally, with the insult to Chris, she had the anger back, the strength to hurt. Her voice came out flat and cold.
"You finally had the guts to say it to my face. The man who paid your rent and bought you a new kitchen last Christmas is a piece of shit. And I guess it's clear what that makes me."
She set down the drink on the coffee table and made for the door. She saw how he lifted one arm involuntarily toward her as she passed him, but she shut it out.
"Where are you going?"
"I'm going to pack my bag, Dad. And then, if I don't get mugged and raped on the way out by one of your oppressed proletarians, I'm going home."
"I thought you didn't want to be on your own in the house."
He said it sulkily, but there was an undertone of fear and regret in his voice now. Dismayed, she realized that it was exactly what she wanted to hear. She could feel the relish bubbling up, hearing it.
"I didn't," she said, "but I'd rather be alone somewhere safe and sane than with you in this shithole."
She didn't turn to see his face as she said it. She didn't need to. Some damage, Chris had once told her, you don't need to see. You know what you've done on impact. You can feel it. All you have to do after that is disengage. She went to pack. File number 2. Account Adjustment. Chapter 15. It finally hit Chris while he was waiting at the counter in Louis Louis for a double-spike cappuccino. He'd sat up late the previous evening, going over the possibilities, and by the time he finally came to bed, Carla was already asleep. More and more that was becoming the pattern. Work on the Cambodia contract was keeping him later and later at Shawn. He was forced to relegate his self-defense classes and gun practice to lunchtime, which stretched the day even longer. Carla was getting home anything from 2 to 5 hours ahead of him during the week, and they had given up any pretense of dining together. He ate the remains of what she had cooked for herself earlier, and talked desultorily to her about his day. Loading the dishwasher was usually the only shared activity of the evening. After that, one of them would retire upstairs to read, leaving the other marooned down in the living room with the entertainment deck. There was an air of detached politeness to their lives now. They had sex at increasingly irregular intervals and argued less than they ever had before, because they rarely had the time or energy to talk about anything of significance. They kept meaning to take a long weekend together, somewhere like New York or Madrid, and use the time to recharge, but somehow it never came together. Either Carla forgot to book the Saturday off with Mel, or Chris was suddenly needed for a weekend meeting with the Cambodia team. Summer came on, pleasantly mellow, but the layer of superficiality continued to thicken over their day-to-day life, and Chris found himself enjoying the new weather only in moments of isolation that he was later curiously unwilling to share with Carla. He lay awake beside her, turning the game over in his mind until he finally fell asleep. On the drive-in that morning he'd tried again, but he'd been too sleepy from the night before. In the last few weeks his habitual driver's caution had grown lax to a point that under other circumstances might have been called recklessness. As it was, the attitude made perfect sense. Following the Nakamura challenge, word had gotten out about the dangerous new player at the Shawn table, and no one among the young no-name challengers was keen to go up against Chris Faulkner's clearly identifiable Saab custom. The vehicle's spaced armouring, and Mitsui Jones's demise at its owner's hands, were equally thoroughly mythologized among the driving fraternity, detail upon invented detail until it was impossible even for Chris to separate the true facts from the thicket of embellishments that had sprung up around them. In the end he gave up trying, and started to live with the legend. In this he was probably the last person on board. Amid all the hype, one thing had been universally accepted in the City of London weeks ago. There had to be easier ways to carve a name for yourself than go up against Chris Faulkner.
"Double cap for Chris!" yelled the girl at the counter.
He was on first-name terms with the staff of Louis Louise these days. They'd torn out the front cover of GQ that month and pinned it up behind the counter. Reluctantly, he'd autographed it, and now, every time he went in, his carefully groomed features grinned back at him from beneath the imprisoning gloss and black ink scrawl. It made him slightly uneasy. Fame had dripped like sap all over him, and now it was hardening into amber and he was trapped inside for all to see. Fan sites were starting to give him serious coverage for the first time since the death of Edward Quain. East European working girls with unlikely stage names and credit card hotlines were in his mail, plying him with suggestions of varying subtlety. "And you're pinned down, over-deployed, no way to—" The solution boiled out at him like the milk froth from the steamer, bubbling up on itself as it unfolded. It might have been the cross-hatched patterning of the yellow and black tiles behind the counter, or maybe just the results of dissociative thinking, a technique he'd picked up from a psych seminar the week before. Whatever it was, he fielded the insight and took it back up in the Shawn elevator with his coffee.
"Cambodia resourcing continues to lead the rising stock trend," the elevator informed him as they powered upward, "with end-of-day trading at—"
He tuned it out. He already knew. Mike Bryant was talking to the machine. Chris could hear him through the door, dictating in jagged pieces to the data down. It was a chewed-over version of a document to the Cambodian rebels that they'd been working on most of yesterday. The East Asia Trade and Investment Commission were leaning on them for charter compliance with an uncharacteristic fervor. INDESP reports suggested Nakamura bribes were going in at high level.
"We have no interest in the so-called—no, scratch that. No interest in the areas you have designated resettlement zones, nor are we concerned with what goes on within those zones. The administration of the camps is, of course, not within our jurisdiction, provided no overt human rights abuse. Provided no human rights abuse, not within our jurisdiction, provided, given that—" "Oh, fuck it."
Chris grinned and knocked at the door.
"What?"
Bryant bellowed.
"Having trouble?" "Chris!"
Bryant stood poised in the middle of his office space, arms slung on a polished wood baseball bat that he'd braced at the nape of his neck. It gave him the posture of a man crucified, and the tiredness in his face did nothing to alter the impression.
"Would you believe I've been on this motherfucker since 8 this morning? It has to go to the uplink at noon, and I'm still splitting fucking hairs on the covering letter. Listen to this."
He walked to the desk and read aloud from a piece of hard copy that curled from the data-down printer.
"The administration of the camps is, of course, not within our jurisdiction, provided no human rights abuse occurs. Siri's going to go through the roof if we send him that. He'll say we're implying the Friday statement's a lie."
"It is, isn't it?"
"Please." Bryant rolled his neck against the wood of the bat. "I'm trying to do politics here. We can't imply he's lying."
"I thought we were going to go with, given that no human rights abuse is occurring." Bryant shook his head.
"Won't wash with the UN. There's an amnesty report doing the rounds in Norway, and no one's prepared to deny it at ministerial level. We've got to stay vague but firm. That's a direct quote from Hewitt.
Vague but firm. Chris pulled a face. Nice.
Fucking amnesty.
Yeah, well, shit happens. Chris came and stood at Bryant's shoulder, reading the hard copy. What about...
He tore the sheet from the printer and scanned it. Bryant unslung the baseball bat from his shoulder and parked it in a corner.
Confident. That's it. Look, admin of the camps, blah, 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 not within our jurisdiction, and we are confident that no human rights abuse... No, that none of the alleged human rights abuse has occurred.
He handed back the sheet.
How about that?
Bryant snatched it.
You bastard! 45 fucking minutes I've been staring at this.
Caffeine. Chris held up his takeout from Louis Lewis. Want some?
I'm all caffeined out. I was in at 6 with Makin, and this landed on my desk an hour ago from upstairs. Notley and the policy board. Response required, as if I didn't have enough else to do. Let's see. That none of the alleged human rights abuse has occurred. Right. Now, what about this? However, we cannot permit your forces to obstruct the passage of fuel and supplies.
Try forces operating in the area. Takes the sting out of it and makes him feel like a big man, like you're asking him to police the zone generally, not just get a grip on his own troops.
Bryant muttered and scribbled on the hard copy as he read it back.
However, we cannot permit forces operating in the area to obstruct the passage of fuel and blah, 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 blah. That's it. Brilliant!
Chris shrugged.
Ready wrapped. I used the same scam on the Panthers of Justice a couple of weeks back, and they lapped it up. Stopped the banditry dead. All most of these rebels really want is some kind of recognition.
Paternal acknowledgement from some kind of patriarchal authority. According to Lopez, it had them swaggering around posting police directives in every village.
Mike barked a laugh.
Lopez?
That Joaquin Lopez?
Yeah.
So you put Harris up to tender after all?
Well, like you said, it was our investment he was fucking with. And Lopez works flat out for 0.5% less of total. Really took Harris apart in the bullring, too, apparently.
Yeah, he's still young enough to have the drive. Harris burned out years ago, it's just no one ever called him on it. You did the whole industry a service putting him out.
It was your idea. If anything, I owe you one for the advice. So anyway, what's this 6 a.m. shit with Makin? Anything I should know about?
Nah, shouldn't think.
Bryant stopped.
Actually,
maybe I should bounce it off you.
You worked the name, didn't you? North Andean Monitored Economy, back when you were HM?
Chris nodded.
Yeah, we were into the ME in a big way. Anybody with a decent emerging markets portfolio had to be. Why, what's going on down there now?
Ah, it's fucking Echevarria again. You remember that first day we met in the gents? I told you I was off to see some greasy dictator for a budget review.
That was Hernán Echevarria? I thought he was dying.
No such luck. The old bastard's pushing 80. He's had major surgery twice in the last decade, and he's still hanging on. He's grooming his eldest son in true corrupt land-owning motherfucker fashion to take over the whole show when he's gone. And as you'd expect with these hacienda families, the son's a complete fucking waste of space. Spends all his time in Miami doing the casinos, powdering his nose and fucking the local gringas.
Chris offered another shrug.
Sounds okay.
Easy enough to control, anyway.
Not on present showing.
Bryant punched a couple of points on the data-down screen and the display shifted.
See? Echevarria Jr.'s making a lot of friends in Miami.
Investor friends.
Oh.
Yes. Oh. Fresh money, most of it homegrown, but some from Tokyo and Beijing via U.S. management funds. Have a look at this little shot.
Bryant turned the data-down screen to face Chris.
Taken aboard Hytham Al Ratrout's private yacht last week. You'll recognize some faces.
It was a standard paparazzo shot. Hurried and unflattering angles on people who usually only appeared in the public eye coated in a high media gloss. Chris spotted two Hollywood pin-ups of the moment displaying the cleavage for which they were famous. The U.S. Secretary of State, caught picking the olive out of his martini, and...
Over on the left, you've got Echevarria Jr., the one in the Ingram suit and the stupid hat. And that man next to him is Conrad Rimshaw, executive head of conflict investment for Lloyd Paul, New York.
On the other side, and toward the back, you've got Martin Meldrick from the Calder's Rapid Capital Deployment Division. The vultures are gathering. But the father's still ours so far, right?
So far. Bryant nodded and touched another part of the screen. The photo minimized and gave way to a spreadsheet.
But it's an uphill struggle. These are from the budget review I mentioned. The stuff in red is contested. He wants more. We can't let him have it.
There was a lot of red.
The Echevarrias have been with Sean's Madrid office ever since Hernan pulled the coup back in 27. Good, solid clients. Our emerging markets division backed them all through the Civil War and the crackdown afterward.
Bryant bent back fingers one at a time as he enumerated.
Fuel and ammunition, medical supplies, helicopter gunships, counter-subversion trainers, interrogation technology. All at knockdown prices, and for more than 20 years it's all paid off big time. Quiescent population, low-wage economy, export-oriented. Standard neoliberal dream.
But not any more.
But not any more. We've got another generation of guerrillas in the mountains screaming for land reform, another generation of disaffected student youth in the cities, and we're all back to square one. The emerging markets got scared and dropped the whole thing like a hot brick straight into Conflict Investment's lap. Hewitt gave it to Makin.
Nice of her?
Yeah. Well, this was just after Guatemala, so Makin's rep was riding pretty high. Top commission analyst for the year and all that. I guess Hewitt thought he'd swing it in his sleep, but things didn't work out, so they brought me in to assist. Now Makin's having to share Echevarria with me, and I've got to say...
Bryant walked across to the door and pressed it completely closed, his voice lowered.
I've got to say he's not handling it all that well.
Chris leaned against the edge of Bryant's desk, feeling the friendly warmth of trust and a shared conspiracy coming off the other man.
So what's the problem?
Bryant sighed.
Problem is, Makin doesn't know how to handle Echevarria. See, he's used to these penny-ante revolutionaries holed up in the jungle with their peasant education programs, and he thinks Echevarria's just the same animal made good.
Oops.
Yeah, I've told him. The Echevarrias are as close as you get to nobility in that part of the world. That's how come the link with Europe. Old Hernan traces his ancestors right back to Pizarro's original conquistadores. As he never fucking tires of telling us. Of course, all that means is he's descended from some dirt, poor younger son mercenary glory roader who grabbed a seat on the boat over from Spain. But it isn't cool to mention that in budget meetings.
Makin said that?
Bryant laughed.
No, I'm exaggerating. Makin's too damn good a negotiator for that. But it smokes off him every time Echevarria starts in on that nobility rap. You can almost see his lip curl. Echevarria sees it too, and that fucking Hispanic pride stokes up and Makin's lip curls some more, and there we are, deadlocked. We're trying to lock him into something long-term so that when he finally croaks, the name will be stable and, more important, ours. But he gets more hostile every time we talk to him. Now he wants double-figure percentage increases in the military budget to put down the rebels, and there's no way we can afford to give that to him and keep the fund managers happy. The problem is, he's taken the whole thing personally.
So he won't sign?
He might eventually.
Bryant picked up the baseball bat again, twirled it through the air and shipped it across one shoulder.
If I can talk him around. But eventually might be too late. He's not a well man. If he dies or his condition deteriorates too much, Junior takes over and then we're fucked. Junior doesn't have his old man's illusions about the European connection, and he's pissed off with Makin for his attitude. He'll bring in Lloyd Paul, or Calder's Rap Cap just to snub us. And they'd just love to buy us out.
Chris sipped at his coffee and thought about it while Bryant paced toward the window, playing imaginary curveballs off the bat. When the other man turned back to face him, he set the styrofoam canister down on the desk with studied calm.
"What about the rebels?" he asked.
"The rebels?"
Bryant spread his hands in supplication.
"Come on. Who the fuck are they? This is a 20-year client we're talking about. You can't write that off against some bearded campesino hiding out in the hills. There's probably 50 different factions and fronts, all squabbling about their revolutionary lineage. We don't know them. We don't have the time to get to know them. And anyway,
I know them."
"What?"
"I said I know them.
HM Emerging Markets did an in-depth survey of the ME's radical factions last year. Chris gestured open-handed. We flew out there, Mike. I've got the files at home somewhere. Bryant gaped.
You're bullshitting me.
Do you a profile by Thursday?
Jesus! What did you do, just come up here to make my day?
Oh. Chris picked up his coffee and crossed to the low table where Mike kept the chessboard. He hooked up a knight between index and second finger and relocated it. Almost forgot. Check. Bryant grinned and feinted at him with the bat. Chris caught it with his spare hand.
Motherfucker.
Yeah. Chris looked at the board. And mate in seven, I reckon. Chapter 16. The HM files were in the garage, stacked on an upper shelf next to a box of worn gear bearings that Carla had hung on to for some unfathomable reason. Chris went up on a stepladder to retrieve the disc he wanted and nearly turned an ankle jumping down afterward.
Fuck!
Had Carla been there to see it, he thought, she would have laughed. She would have laughed out loud, and he would have joined in, pretending that his ego was not pricked through, and, after a few moments, the fleeting anger at being mocked would have leached out for real. But Carla was at an evening course with two other mechanics from Mel's Autofix, learning about developments in virtual design technology, and the house echoed with her absence. He went through to the study and fed the disk into the data down. A search protocol swam up onto the screen. North Endian monitored economy, he told the machine. Hernan Echevarria. Political opponents. The search protocol dissolved, and a series of thumbprint photos began to spring up like multicolored blisters in its place. Chris stood and watched for a moment as the program resized the rapidly multiplying images, trying vainly to fit them all onto a single screen page. Then he went out to the living room to fetch the whiskey. He'd built this file in a no-star hotel room overlooking the luminous nighttime surf of the Caribbean. Emmett McCall sent two teams out to the name. One highly publicized visit, booked into the Bogota Hilton, whose function was largely cosmetic, and one stealth audit crew, flown in under the cover of a shoestring movie company's location scouting. It had been a stupid kind of fun at first, until the policing data started to flow in. Chris remembered velvet black nights, street life, and lanterns strung in the street outside. Sweat rolling off his body and brow, pricked out in almost equal quantities by the humidity and the details from the detention records. His fingers leaving damp prints on the keys of the laptop. He drank cane rum and smoked atrocious local cigarettes and somehow kept it all in perspective most of the time. Just sometimes he paused and lifted his fingers from the keyboard as if he had heard something, because even the rum could not keep out the animal instinctive knowledge that the things the reports described were going on right now in police stations across the city. He never heard screams, he told himself, then and later. It was the reports talking, working at his imagination like a feeble dentist at an infected tooth. That was all. He heard nothing. The telephone rang. He jerked around, one hand on the neck of the whiskey bottle, and stared at the little blue screen across the room from him. The call bell symbol pulsed on and off in green, in time with the soft chiming. Who? Can't be Carla. He checked his watch. The seminar still had half an hour to run, and anyway he'd had the thought before he knew what time it was. As their separate work schedules chewed off more and more of the time they used to spend together, they'd fallen out of the habit of checking in with each other for anything other than pure necessity. The telephone rang. He watched it stupidly, holding the whiskey, thoughts locked up. Work would have used the data down, from habit and from the manual. There was a shorn directive against talking shop on unscreened lines. The phone rang. Eric, ringing to back down from the ludicrous sulk Carla had described when Chris got back from the north. Chris grimaced. That particular Viking? Not likely. Just answer the fucking thing, for Christ's sake. He crossed to the terminal and thumbed the accept. The blue background blipped out and a picture sank into place. For a curious moment, Chris wasn't sure what he was looking at. He made out dark, glossy hair and a profile seemingly pillowed on twin cushions that... Moaning gusted through the air from the speaker. The profile turned, mouth open. A hand appeared, enamel red-tipped. Adrenaline bubbled abruptly through Chris's head as the picture made sense. He was watching a slice of holoporn, downloaded direct to the phone link. A heavily made-up woman with long black tresses was crouched over an equally painted blonde partner, sucking and nibbling at a pair of breasts so large and so perfectly rounded it was hard to believe they were physically attached to either participant. Chris sank onto the arm of the sofa, watching. The shot dilated a little, and background detail emerged. The two women were sprawled on what appeared to be some kind of exercise bench, and wore nothing beyond a few studded leather accessories that served only to lift and separate curved areas of flesh. The blonde half of the duo was on her back and upside down, hair trailing to the floor. The other woman had somehow contrived to straddle her partner, but leave her own backside raised high in the air like the top of a child-drawn heart. The twin mounds of buttocks mirrored the silicon-enhanced globes of the woman below so that a bizarre kind of vertical symmetry was created. You could almost believe you were looking at a single hourglass-shaped creature with the incidental appendages of limbs and faces added after the event. Chris felt the blood stirring through his stomach and puddling into his prick as the two women faked their way toward a mutual climax. The dark-haired performer was evidently cast in the role of dominatrix, and she worked the other woman's flesh with much snarling and flashing of purple-painted eyes, while the blonde beneath her moaned and rubbed semi-convincingly at her own improbable breasts. The dominatrix! The thought skated almost casually across the rink of his mind, replacing something else he'd been going to think. Was Liz Linshaw? He leaned forward uncomfortably over his erection. Confirmed, the recognition sent a small shiver up his spine. Liz Linshaw had aged a few years since the footage was shot, but behind the purple eyeshadow and the dyed black hair, the face was unmistakable. It was the same line of cheekbone and nose, the same long, mobile mouth, the same slightly crooked teeth. Chris's eyes flickered from the face to the exposed flesh below it. 6 weeks ago, at the Tebbit Center studio, he'd seen the steep curve of her cleavage loaded into just-glimpsed lingerie under an open-necked blouse. He'd fallen asleep that night, thinking about it, and, he only admitted to himself now, he'd looked for it on the morning prom and app bulletins since. Now, here it was, laid out for his perusal at leisure. And it was, he noticed, the same steep curve. Liz Linshaw's breasts were not of the same epic proportions as her performing partner's, but they were still cosmetic standard enough to defy gravity without external support. The nipples, now being forced mock-sadistically into the blonde woman's mouth, were large and dark and blunt. If there were scars where the implants had gone in, they were lost in the all-over tan. Chris was rock-hard. He watched the blonde woman's mouth dragged and smeared down the length of Liz Linshaw's body to the juncture of her thighs. The panting and moaning grew mutual as the two women got into the inevitable top-to-tail clinch and filled their brightly taloned hands with bronzed flesh. Chris's hand moved unwillingly across the buckle of his belt. Semi-convincing or not, white lights splashed across the window and drenched the curtains. The Land Rover crunched up the drive. Chris leapt up and snapped the phone off. The liquid sounds of orgasm evaporated into stillness. For a moment he stood over the unit, glaring at it. The message option pulsed. Download message, dump message, replay message, download, dump, replay, download, dump, replay, download. He stabbed the screen, and the copying bar filled from left to right like a tiny, unrolling carpet in mauve. The Land Rover's engine stilled. A door clunked, open and closed. He stabbed the eject button and snatched the mini-disc as it emerged. It fell from his fingers, hit the floor, and rolled. Footsteps on gravel. He cast about, tiny trip hammers in his temples. The disc glinted silver from under an armchair. Carla's recognition tag scraped on the lock. He bent and grabbed the disc, buried it in his pocket on the way out of the living room. He heard the front door open as he reached the study. He made it to his seat.
"Chris, I'm home."
"Just a minute."
The erection, he was relieved to find, had melted in the panic. His jeans felt almost loose. He swiveled on the chair as Carla came in and kissed him on the cheek.
"Work?"
There was just a hint of weary resignation in the single word as she glanced past him at the screen.
"That's right."
He returned the kiss, feeling as if he fit badly into his own skin. The words were jumbled and overlarge on his tongue.
"It's some stuff I'm digging out for Michael."
"You eaten?"
"Yeah, the rest of the curry. You?"
"On the way,"
she grimaced.
"Kebab."
"Yeah, I can smell it."
"Yeah, sorry."
She stopped abruptly and leaned back a little, holding his head between her palms.
"You okay? You look a bit pale."
"I'm..."
He gusted a sigh, pushing out some of the tension, jerked his head at the screen so she had to let go.
"It's just some of this stuff. We're looking at the North Andean monitored economy. I'd forgotten the shit they get up to in police cells out there."
She moved away.
"No worse than what's going on in Cambodia, from what I hear."
"We're leaning on them to stop that," he told her.
"Yeah?"
There was a dull disinterest in her voice as she walked out of the room. A coat of detachment, they had both started to evolve as an alternative to the fights there was no longer time or energy for. He went after her, back into the living room, where the phone terminal stood in the corner. He remembered, with a jolt through the stomach, that he had not erased the original message.
"Carla?"
"What?"
He moved up close to her and put one arm on the juncture of neck and shoulder. The gesture felt clumsy, unaccustomed. It was weeks since they'd fucked. She looked at him out of suspicious eyes.
"What, Chris?"
He ran his fingers up into the hair behind her ear and tugged through until his hand was clasping the back of her head. It was a caress that invariably set her cooking, but it still felt awkward. He closed the final gap between them, relieved to find that his erection had returned in force. She felt it pressed between them, and a thin little smile appeared on her lips.
"So, what's got into you?"
He kissed her. After a couple of moments, she warmed to it.
"I've missed you,"
he said when their mouths split apart.
"I've missed you too.
Come upstairs with me."
She had started to rub at the crotch of his jeans with one hand. The other worked at the buckle on his belt.
"What's wrong with right here?"
He hesitated. The passion in the moment guttered down. She looked up from what her hands were doing, terrifyingly attuned to the confusion fogging his head.
"Chris?"
"I don't want you getting carpet burns," he said, and hauled her off her feet, the classic wedding threshold lift.
One hand went to her breast, cupping, and... The blonde gobbles down Liz Linshaw's nipples, smearing crimson lipstick. She laughed.
"Well, well, romance!"
Staggering a little, he got her upstairs. They crashed onto the bed and shed their clothes. Carla turned toward him, naked, and he felt a tiny crystal of warmth drip and slide somewhere deep inside him. He had forgotten how beautiful her body was. The broad-shouldered, long-boned, pale expanse of it, the flat width of stomach and the full breasts above, breasts that would have been large on a smaller framed woman, but here the swollen hemispheres, flesh taut to breaking point, kneaded by red-taloned hands. He blinked and forced the image aside, focused on the woman he was with, slotting into the old, comfortable sequence of postures and pressures, the places she liked to be touched, the eventual coupling.
Liz Linshaw's mouth, burrowing.
He could not lose it. Even when Carla got on her hands and knees ahead of him the way they both liked to finish, he fantasized the other two women into existence on the bed with them. He imagined them vampire-like, clutching and sucking at Carla's flesh and his own, and he came with that last image printed indelibly across his eyes. They left, then, dragging his post-coital warmth away with them like the fur of a newly slaughtered animal. And afterward, when Carla shifted and murmured and tightened her arms around him, all he could feel was trapped inside something that wasn't his.
"This is fucking great stuff!"
Mike Bryant paced about the office space, leafing through the sheaf of hard copy. Chris sat in a corner armchair and watched him. He hadn't slept well, and there was a spreading ache behind his left eye. He was having a hard time getting up to the same level of enthusiasm as Bryant.
"I mean, Jesus, these guys have got some grievances. Just look at it. Better than a dozen different insurgent leaders, and every single one has had family tortured to death or disappeared. Fantastic!
Primary emotional motivation. P.E. fucking M. Right out of Reed and Mason. Textbook diehard revolutionaries. They'll never quit. Listen, we only need to hold about a third. No, less than a third of this stuff over Echevarria's head, and he should cave right in." "And if he doesn't?"
"Of course he will. What's wrong with you? We'd only need to persuade about three of these groups to team up, give them some second-hand Kalashnikovs out of stock, and Christ knows we've got enough of those. They'd piss all over Echevarria's regular army."
Chris's temple throbbed. "Yeah, but what if he doesn't scare?"
"Chris, come on." Mike looked at him reproachfully. "You're ruining my day here."
"What if, Mike? Fucking think about it."
"Jesus, you got out of bed the wrong side today. All right."
Bryant threw himself into another armchair opposite, dumped his feet on the coffee table between.
"Let's be grown up about it."
"What if? Contingency planning. Like I said, we wave about a third of these guys in his face, and we tell him there are twice as many more where those came from, right?"
"Right."
"Then, if he doesn't see sense, we'll use someone out of the other two-thirds. That way, whatever reprisals he takes, he'll be hitting the wrong people. Meanwhile, we talk to the front-runner, and if necessary, set him up with what he needs. That'll be... let's see." Bryant flipped through the hard copy again.
"This guy, Arbenz, maybe, the People's Liberation Front, or whatever it is. Or Barranco's Revolutionary Brigade, or Diaz. They're all strong contenders. You were there. Who do you make for the best bet?"
"Well, not Arbenz. He got shot up in a gunship raid a couple of weeks ago. Didn't you catch the bulletin?"
"Fucked if I remember."
Bryant snapped his fingers.
"Wait a minute. That business with the villages in the south. Echevarria's been strafing them again, fucking shithead. You know he made me a direct promise those BAE helicopters wouldn't be used against civilians this year.
Lucky we didn't issue a press statement on that one."
"Yeah, well, your BAE gunships shattered Arbenz's legs from the hips down, and apparently they were running that bioware ammunition, the stuff we saw at Farnborough back in January. Slugs coated with immune system inhibitors. Very nasty. They've got him in a field hospital in the mountains, but the last I heard from Lopez, it's touch and go if he'll make it."
Chris rubbed at his eye and wondered about painkillers.
"And even if he does, he'll be in no condition to conduct a campaign any time soon."
"Okay, so that's Arbenz out. What about Barranco?"
"Yeah, I'd leave Barranco alone, too, unless you absolutely have to use him. I met him once. He's committed, and he's short on ego. Tough to win over."
Bryant pulled a face.
"You met Diaz, too, right?"
"Couple of times, yeah. He's a better bet. Very pragmatic. Strong sense of his place in history. He wants his name on a statue somewhere before he dies. Oh, and he's a real Shakespeare nut."
"You're winding me up."
"No, seriously. He can quote the fucking stuff. Got a scholarship on some bullshit liberal arts exchange program in the States when he was a student. He gave me Hamlet, Macbeth, what's it, King Lear, you name it. All word perfect."
Chris shrugged.
"Well, sounded like it was word perfect anyway. What do I know? Anyway, he told me, get this, he always wanted to visit Britain and see the Mother of Parliaments."
"What?"
Bryant barked laughter.
"You are winding me up."
"I swear, Mother of Parliaments. That's what he said."
"The Mother of Parliaments. Man, I love it. I almost hope Echevarria doesn't cave in, just so we can have this guy across."
Macon, perhaps predictably, was less amused by it all. He went through the stapled paperwork, one snatched aside sheet at a time, without saying a word, then tossed the whole thing onto his polished desktop so it slid away from him. He looked across the desk to where Chris and Mike sat in steel-framed chairs, bracketing him. He focused on Bryant.
"I seriously don't think this is the way to go, Mike."
Bryant wasn't up for it. He said nothing, just rolled his head in Chris's direction.
"Listen, Nick," Chris leaned forward, "I've worked the name before, and I'm telling you—" "You are telling me nothing. I've been working Latin America CI longer than you've been here. I took top commission in the Americas market last year."
Bryant cleared his throat.
"A year before last."
"I'm in it for this year as well, Mike."
Makin's voice stayed even, but behind the steel-framed glasses his face looked betrayed.
"When the unresolveds come in."
"Oh, come on, Nick." Chris felt a tight, feral jag of pleasure as he swung the comeback.
"That was last season. First thing you ever said to me, man. Can't live off stuff like that indefinitely. It's a whole new quarter. Time for fresh meat. Another new approach. Remember that?"
Makin looked away.
"I don't remember saying that, no."
"Well, you did, Nick."
Bryant got up and brushed something off the shoulder of his suit.
"I was there. Now, this is no longer under discussion. We are going to do it Chris's way, because, to be honest, your Echevarria game plan is making me tired."
"Mike, I know how these fucking spics work. This is the wrong move."
Bryant looked down at him. He seemed more disappointed with the other man than anything else.
"This isn't Guatemala, Nick. Chris is the resident name expert, you like it or not. Now you talk to him, and get this stuff into a usable form by Monday." "I meant what I said. I am tired of dicking about with that old fuck. We go up Lincoln with Echevarria and his cabinet next week, and I want the axe over his head by then. You coming for a coffee, Chris?"
Sure.
Chris got to his feet. "Nick, you'll call me, right?" Makin made a noise in his throat. At the door, Bryant turned and looked back across the office.
"Hey, Nick. No hard feelings, huh? It's just we've let this slide too far. It's getting out of hand. Time to bring in the riot squad, you know. I don't want Notley looking in on us like we're a bunch of kids just set fire to the kitchen. That's not good for anyone."
They left Makin with it. "You threatening him?" asked Chris in the elevator. Bryant grinned.
"Bit."
The doors opened at ground level, and they walked out into the arching, light-filled space of the tower's lobby area. Fountain splash and an ambient subsonic vibe filled the air. Chris felt his mouth flex into a grin of his own.
"You pissed off with him, then?"
"Nick? Nah. Just he's too fucking impressed with himself is all. Ever since that Guatemala thing. He just needs to know where the orders are coming from, then he jumps. Jesus, look at that."
Hung in the air above one of the fountains, a huge Shawn Associates holo ran back and forth flicker-cut footage of the Cambodian conflict. Crosshair graphics sprang up and tracked selected hardware as it appeared on screen. Helicopters, assault rifles, medical gear, camera zeroing in, logistical data scrolling down alongside each sniper-caught item. Make, specs, cost, Shawn contribution and involvement.
"This the BBC footage?"
asked Bryant. He'd handed publicity to Chris a couple of weeks ago.
"At base, yeah. We bought it right out of the can in Phnom Penh, in case there was something inappropriate in there. You never can tell with that guy, Sile. He's a real fucking crusader.
Won a Pilger Award last year. Anyway, the woman at Imagicians said they'd generate some of the closer detail themselves, like for the medical hardware. They can shoot some real state-of-the-art life support stuff in the studio, then mix and match on the pallet so it looks like it was really there." Chris nodded up at the hollow.
"Looks good, huh?"
"Yeah, not too shabby.
So did Sile cut up rough when they took his footage off him?"
Chris shrugged.
"Don't think he got any say. We made sure there was a program producer out there for the handover, standard sponsorship terms. And what we handed them back had enough battle sequences to come across as gritty realism, you know, corpses on fire, that sort of stuff."
"No women or children, right?"
"No, ran it myself on the uplink. It's clean."
In the hollow, a Cambodian guerrilla commander appeared, face weary. He rattled away in Khmer. Subtitling sprang up in red letters.
It is a hard fight, but with the help of our corporate partners, our victory is as certain as...
He really saying that? Bryant asked curiously.
Think so. Chris was tracking a well-endowed blonde woman across the floor space.
Think they give them cue cards or something?
You know, sometimes I think I could just come down here and stand under the subsonics for half an hour. Save myself buying the coffee.
Bryant spotted where Chris was looking.
That's not subsonics.
Come on, Mike.
Yeah, that reminds me. Want to go to a party tomorrow night?
Party in the zones? Chris and Mike had been back across the cordons a few times since the Falkland incident, though never back to that particular pub and never quite as wrecked as they had been that night. At first, Chris was nervous on these visits, but Mike Bryan's easy familiarity with the cordon zones and their nightlife slowly won him over. He came to see that there was a trick to handling things there, and Bryant knew it. You didn't flaunt your elite status, but neither did you try to play it down. You acted like who you were. You didn't try to be liked, and in most cases you were accorded a wary respect. In time, the respect might develop into something else, but you didn't expect that, and you didn't need it to have a good time.
Why should it be in the zones? Bryant asked innocently.
Oh, I don't know. They stepped through the armored glass doors and into the street. The sun fell warm on their faces.
Because the last three were?
Bullshit. What about Julie Pinion's bash?
Okay, the last two, then. And Julie's wasn't far off, come to that.
I'm sure she'd be thrilled to hear that, price she paid for that duplex. That's an up-and-coming regenerated area, Chris.
So it is. I'd forgotten. They pushed into Louie Louie's and nodded at familiar faces in the line. Chris's fame had eroded sufficiently that all he got from his shorn colleagues these days were grunts and the odd grin.
So tell me about this party.
Mike leaned back on the tiled wall.
Remember Troy?
From the Falkland, sure. They'd run into the Jamaican a couple more times in clubs on the other side of the wire, but in Chris's mind he was irrevocably linked with the events of that night.
Well, turns out his eldest son just got a scholarship to the Thatcher Institute. Fast-track international finance and economics program. Guaranteed placement with a major consulting firm at the end of it. So he's throwing a party at his place. You are cordially invited.
So it is in the fucking zones.
What? Nah, Troy doesn't live in the zones. He moved out years ago. Got a place on the edge of Dulwich.
Which edge?
Look, it's a better area than Julie Pinion picked, all right? You don't want to come, I'll tell him you're working late. On a Friday.
He invited me?
Yeah, like I said. Cordially. Bring Faulkner, he said.
Nice of him.
Yeah, you gotta come. Troy's parties are fucking cool. Lots of powders and potions, big sound systems. Really good mix of people, too. Suits, media, DJs, dealers.
Bryant's face fell abruptly.
Shit. You know what? I bet fucking Liz'll be there.
Chapter 17.
Look, I really don't think it's going to be your kind of thing.
Why not?
Carla folded her arms and leaned back against the door of the freezer.
Too high class for me? Am I going to show you up?
That isn't fair. I've asked you to come to every Shawn function we've had this year.
Yes, very dutiful of you.
And that's really not fucking fair. I wanted you there every time, including all the times you said no. I wanted you to be there with me.
He lowered his voice.
I was proud of you. I wanted to show people that.
You mean you wanted to show off?
Ah, Chris made a helpless gesture. Fuck you, Carla. I put myself on the line for you every single...
If you're going to talk to me like that...
She was already moving across the kitchen and away from him.
I'm going to bed. Good night.
Fine. Fuck off, then.
He stood, fists knotted, surrounded by the twinned debris of another evening's separate dining, while she walked out on him. Again. Her voice drifted back down the stairs.
I've got better things to do tomorrow night anyway.
Fine, then. Fuck off!
He bawled the last two words after her, dismayed at the sudden detonation of fury in his guts. She didn't answer.
For a while he crashed plates and cutlery about loading the dishwasher with a lack of care or interest that he knew could sometimes drag her back into the kitchen to take over. He was kidding himself, and he knew it. This was a new level of hostility they'd reached. He selected a clean tumbler and went to look for the whiskey, poured the glass half full while he stared into the dead blue glare of the TV. The end titles of whatever mindless terrorists threaten civilization flick they had just spun already gone, already wiped off the screen as cleanly as the details of plot and action from his mind. Rage evaporating into remorse and a creeping sense of desolation. A vicious clarity caught up with him just before he knocked back the drink. He was glad of the fight, he knew abruptly, glad of the out it had given him. He was relieved she wouldn't be coming with him. Relieved because he took the knowledge by the throat and drowned it. Troy Morris's home might not have been in the cordon zones, but you could see a zone checkpoint just down the street from his front door, and the quality of house fronts plunged rapidly on the way there. The street was restored Victorian, Troy's place and the surrounding facades carefully painted, windows clean. After that it started to get rough. At the checkpoint end, paint was a flecked rumour on most frontages, and the window glass had become strictly optional. Plastic coverings flapped in a couple of places. The last three houses on both sides of the street had been demolished to provide open ground on either side of the checkpoint. The rubble had been cleared and defoliant kept the weeds down. 100 meters beyond the barriers, the closest structures on the other side were riot fire-blackened and crumbling. A shabby concrete block rose 10 stories high behind the shells, dirty grey facades stained darker with leakage from substandard guttering. Chris spotted someone watching him from a window near the top. It was a perfect summer evening, still fully light after 8 o'clock, and the day's heat was leaching slowly out of the air without the rain that had been threatening all afternoon. Junk salsa thumped out of Troy's opened sash windows, and when Bryant rang the doorbell, the door seemed to blow open on a gust of bass line.
"Mike, good to see you, man!"
Troy was decked out in a Jamaica Test 47 shirt, with Moses Mackenzie's grinning victorious face poking out behind a hollow-shot, fast-bowled cricket ball that seemed to come right off the fabric at you. In contrast, Troy's face seemed unusually sober.
"Hey, Faulkner! You came! That's good!"
Chris murmured something, but Troy had already gone back to Bryant.
"Mike, listen. I need to talk to you later, man."
"Sure. What's the deal?"
Troy shook his head.
"Later's better." "Whatever you need."
Bryant craned his neck to look down the hall.
"Any chance of a spliff?"
"Yeah, somewhere, I guess. That blonde TV face you like, she's here. She's rolling."
"Right."
They went down the hall into the heart of the party. Chris had never been much of a fiesta machine. Growing up smart and strangely accented in a zone school had ensured he was routinely bullied nearly every day of his life and didn't get invited to many parties. Later he learned to fight. Later still he grew into looks that a lot of the cooler female kids liked. Life got easier, but the damage was already done. He remained withdrawn and watchful around other people, found it hard to relax and harder to have fun if he was surrounded. A reputation for moody, cool, approved and codified by male peers and female fans alike, nailed the doors shut on him. By the time he hacked his way into the corporate world, he had exactly the demeanor required for long-term survival. The edgy, peer-thrown